when you're doing pure Morse code reception, and that can also be synthesized by way of digital frequency processing or by way of a Q multiplier. There's lots of ways you can make the receiver more narrowband in order to try to pick up one single Morse code signal at a time. But it turns out that a very well-tuned set of ears do not need the more narrow bandwidth. Let me give you one further word on that. Good common sense would lead you to believe you're listening to a real weak signal in the noise, and as you make the receiver bandwidth more and more narrow, that now you're going to hear that signal with higher and higher signal-to-noise ratio. And if you're watching your signal strength meter, your S meter on the receiver move, as you go to the more narrow filter, the answer is yes. You'll get more movement out of the S meter when you go to the more narrow filter. You then repeat the experiment. You got a guy set with a set of earphones on, and you have him listen to this weak CW signal in the noise, and you first try him with the 3KC wide filter, and then the 2KC wide filter, and the 1KC wide filter, and the 500 Hz filter. If he's a good, skilled CW operator, you'll suddenly discover that his ability to hear that weak signal does not change. The magic of the human hearing system, when it's well trained, is that you can narrow up the bandwidth of your ears to about 50 hertz. Believe it or not, 50 to 70 hertz. Your brain hearing system combination can go to the narrow bandwidth, and the actual bandwidth of the receiver will make it more comfortable for somebody who is unskilled to listen to it, but a thoroughly skilled CW operator gets the same sensitivity out of the more narrow, out of the narrow versus the wide filter. Nothing changes. Opposite of common sense. There's a lot going on, a lot more going on than first meets the eye, if you know what I mean. Okay, I think we've answered Ray's question. I'm going to go on to Artie's question now. N2, Papa Papa Victor or Uniform. Can't read my own writing, Artie. You've got it. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet. Are you still there, Artie? N2 Papa Papa Uniform or Papa Papa Victor? Go ahead, Artie. K2RIW. Okay, maybe. Let's see, we're 4 minutes beyond the hour. Maybe Artie wasn't able to wait. Bernie, you just bubbled to the top of your priority list. You're number one on the runway. K2 Yankee Oscar. Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Evening, Dick. Flaps are down. Throttle is up. Prepare for takeoff. Hold on. Sorry, I had to cough. In the past, you have talked to us about, specifically with HF vertical antennas, about when you raise the feed point above the ground, that you gain an advantage of not having to have as much ground plane around the antenna. I was talking with another club member on the repeater the other day about working 10 meters. He lives in an apartment in the city and has he's about 10, 15 floors up and has a balcony. If he builds an artificial ground plane for his 10-meter antenna on his balcony, does he gain effect of having a raised feed point? Does that impact him in that world? Or does all the steel in the building count as ground and he's effectively at ground level? Just curious if that advantage of raised ground point would help him any.
As you're about to find out, Bernie, there's quite a bit going on here. Whenever an antenna has its phase center of radiation higher up above the ground, because of Earth curvature, local building blockages, mountain blockages, and whatever, extra altitude, with rare exception, always helps. Always gives you a lower angle of radiation to the horizon and whatever. So altitude helps no matter where it's mounted. If it's in the middle of a steel structure, on the top of the steel structure, but it has extra altitude compared to the surrounding terrain, you're going to make an improvement. Now, the ground plane itself, if you did a bunch of careful experiments and you started making larger and shorter ground plane radials because of the steel of the building, you may find out that the length of the radials is not quite as critical because of that particular environment. However, bear in mind that there's nothing magic about forcing the antenna to be a quarter wave ground plane. Everyone thinks that that's a popular antenna, and it's got to be exactly a quarter wave radiator with some kind of a counterpoise structure connected to it. Let me drop. If you're operating above Earth because you're on the second floor or the 14th floor of a building, and you're using the antenna hanging out the window because you live in Manhattan and you've got a very severe landlord that won't allow you to put antennas on the building, or you've got a small balcony and you want to use just the metal railing of the balcony as the counterpoise. If you're smart enough to make the radiator electronically half wave long instead of quarter wave long, you pick up another huge advantage. Not only is the antenna easier to feed as far as the amount of current you have to pour into the antenna, goes much, much lower. But the slight disadvantage is the antenna, when you feed it at one end and it's a half wave long, you're not feeding it in the center, you're feeding a 1500 ohm impedance instead of a 70 ohm impedance. That's a very simple LC network impedance step-up structure. You can build it with transformers, you can build it with coax cables, you can build it with an inductor and a capacitor, you can build it with a Pi network, you can build it with an antenna tuner, it doesn't matter. But once you feed a half wave long radiator at one end, and you live with the 1500 ohm impedance, now the size of the ground plane almost doesn't matter. The metal railing on the balcony might be more than enough counterpoise to do that. Or the metal rim of the window where you're sticking this antenna out the window, and you want to stick it out there at nighttime when you're on the air and bring it back in the day so that the landlord doesn't see it. There's a huge advantage of making that a half wave long. Now, at first you're going to say, a half wave long radiator on 40 meters is 67 feet. Not anywhere near that long. There's nothing magic about making the radiator physically a half wave long. You're making it electronically a half wave long. You can zigzag it, you can wind it up into a coil, you can put loading coils on it, you can make it a great big helical resonator. There's a zillion ways you can do it. There's nothing magic about having it physically a half wave long, with one slight exception. When it's physically a half wave long, it'll have a little bit more vis-wa bandwidth. And so as you make it physically shorter and shorter by putting loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzagging it, winding it in a helical resonator, and so on, as you make it physically shorter, it has less feet of length to radiate through, so to speak. The Q goes up, the bandwidth goes down. As long as you've got to bring enough a bandwidth on your antenna tuner, that becomes a wash. Or if you've made some kind of a physical tuning arrangement where you add this extra little doodad to the antenna when you're on the low end of the band and you take it away when you're on the high end of the band, there's a zillion ways you can get around that. So thoroughly think about a half-wave radiator in that environment. You'll be amazed how many advantages it gives you, Bernie. K2YO, with a little bit of delay if somebody wants to add something to this, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the four beeps.
N2LDY.
N2LDY recognized, but Bernie first. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, that makes good sense to me. The slight follow-up question is, in this world, let's say that you're on the 10th floor of a 20-story building, and you're using the patio structure or fire escape to be your ground plane, I'm assuming it's a little bit problematic that you've got as much steel above you as you do below. If you could just comment on that, and I'm also curious to see what the other gentleman has.
Yeah, if you've got a whole lot of steel above you, and depending on what band you're on and how transparent that is, I mean, make believe you could look at the building before they added all the walls and sheeting, and you're now just looking at the I-beam structure. How transparent is that in your particular frequency? The rest of the building with steel above you probably is going to give you partial blockage in one direction. In other words, if that steel, if your apartment is on the south side of the building, you're going to certainly have quite a bit of blockage to the north because you've got to go through all that steel. There's ways around that, though. The nice thing about RF energy is it just loves to flow around the edges of things. So there are ways you can light up that building so that the edge effect the signal will go crawling out to the edge of the building, go around the corner, and still radiate to the north. It may be a couple of dB weaker, but there's ways of getting there. So by experimenting with horizontal and vertical polarization and circular polarization, by setting up not one antenna, but two of them at right angles, and feeding them at various angles and different distances from the building, you can have a grand old time finding out how to light up the building. In fact, you may be able to drill a small hole in the wall, pick up the actual metal frame of the building itself, and find ways of loading an RF signal into that. As crazy as it sounds, there's nothing wrong with using the steel of the building as the radiator. People have done that, and sometimes with great success. So there's a whole bunch of experiments you could do with that one, Bernie, and I guarantee that at least at the master's level or the doctorate level, you could make a thesis out of this one as to the various ways of lighting up the building and how the propagation and antenna pattern changed accordingly. So when you got lemons, make some lemonade there, Bernie. And I know you guys know how to do that. Let's see, I guess it was Donald. I think it was Donald into LDY. You want to ask a question or add something to this? You got it, Don.
Yeah, I was just curious how the size of the radiator affects the antenna or the tuning or whatever. Like, i.e., let's say you use a 16-gauge stranded wire as opposed to maybe the entire coax of, like, the RG8, you know, where you tie the center of the coax to the shield and use that as your radiator. How do they interact, like, as, you know, in relation to your bandwidth? Over.
Yeah, I think you're coming in through the eastern portion of the machine. You sound very good. Very little difference. You could make an invisible antenna out of 30-gauge wire. You could make it out of 18-gauge, 14-gauge, and 6-gauge. And if you compare the results of the three on most HF frequencies, 80 through 10 meters, you'd be amazed how little difference there was. The 30-gauge wire has a little bit more resistive effects. It's going to run a little bit hotter. You might not be able to pour 1,000 watts into the 30-gauge wire without burning it up right at the feed point because of current flow creating excess heating. But because 30-gauge wire can probably only dissipate about 5 watts before it starts burning up, and you're putting 1,000 watts into it, you can see that you still got 990 watts to be radiated, you know what I mean. So you'd be amazed how little difference there is as a function of diameter. You can get the exact answer by going to the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, way back in 1948, spent about a man year making a whole bunch of measurements. Let me drop. They were building quarter-wave ground plane antennas. They had a great big sheet of metal as the ground plane, and they put as a radiator in there various diameters and various lengths and measured the exact impedance, resistive component, and reactive component. So they measured all impedances you're going to get for any diameter wire you want to use, and it's all very nicely plotted. And when you look at that set of curves, you'll find out that as you change the diameter of the radiator, the resistive component changes almost not at all. It changes as a function of length, but not as a function of diameter of the wire. Almost nothing happens. The reactive component does change a little bit more rapidly when you tune away from resonant frequency when the wire is smaller in diameter. So the antenna becomes a little bit more narrow band when you use smaller diameter wire because of what the reactive component does. But those Brown and Woodward curves, you can see them by going to the website of Dr. Tom Williams, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha. Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha .org. You go to that website, at the bottom of it, you'll see some Yagi information by K2RIW. You'll see an article telling you how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole. And there's also the two curves there, the resistive curve and the reactive curve, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, are presented to you there. You can also find them in Chapter 4 of almost any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. That's where they really came from at first. Let me drop.
Please repeat website.
Yeah, the website is www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. bravoalpha.org, O-R-G. That's the Dr. Tom Williams microwave website. But on the bottom of his first page, you'll see this extra information by K2LIW on impedance matching, Yagi matching as it's called. And there you'll see on the next page when you go there, you'll see the two curves plus about a 1,500-word article telling you how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole you're going to build for the rest of your life. And it doesn't matter if the dipole is 1 foot above the ground, 100 feet above the ground, or in the middle of a Yagi structure. You can get a perfect impedance match to your Yagi without adding extra mechanical structures to the dipole. Ain't that amazing? And so it seems to be a very well-kept secret. I tried getting that article published on a couple of times, and each publisher says that, everybody understands how a dipole works. They don't want to read this. It's the information people need that nobody wants to publish. It's a well-kept secret. Anybody need a fill on that website, K2LIW Listening? So as you can see, Don, the impedance changes very slowly as a function of diameter. So if you try to build an invisible antenna to hide it from the landlord, building it out of 26-gauge enameled wire is not out of the question. Common sense would lead you to believe that, hey, it's got a lot less area, it's going to have a lot lower gain, it's going to have a lot more loss. You'd be amazed how well it works. Very little difference. And that set of curves, because these guys, as I said, they spent a man year measuring the exact resistive and reactive component of the impedance of these monopoles. The article is measured for a monopole, which is, in other words, a quarter-wave ground plane-like antenna. But every dipole you've ever built really is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. The proof of that is you can take any dipole that's operating correctly. Right down the middle of the dipole, you put a sheet of metal at right angles to the dipole itself, and nothing happens. It has the exact same impedance, because that's the neutral voltage point. You know, at one inch at a time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, the left-hand side is negative. There's a sheet you could put down the settle down the center that's right in the neutral plane, and nothing happens. And so, as I said, another one of the well-kept secrets, let me drop, is that every dipole is really a pair of monopoles back-to-back. And once you're building monopoles back-to-back, the next question somebody might ask is, do they both have to be identical in size? And the answer is no. You put a pair of monopoles back-to-back, quarter-wave ground planes back-to-back, collinear, if you know what I mean. Make one a little bit longer and the other one shorter so that you still have the same composite resonant frequency. It'll work. What really is going on here is that there's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the dead center. If you have the right kind of a balancing structure so that you're not adding extra current to the outside of the transmission line, common mode current, you can feed the dipole in the center, 10% off of center, 50% off of center, 90% off of center. You can feed it at the open circuit end by, you know, having no gap in the center of the dipole, make it a half wave long, and feed the open circuit end with reference to ground. You'll be feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance, but you'll get the exact same pattern, the exact same efficiency. And if you're smart enough to lay a piece of wire vertically polarized up the tree, and the bottom of the wire comes 5 feet away from the ground, and you feed the bottom of that wire as a half-wave dipole fed at the open end, and it's suspended by the tree, that would be an extremely high-performance antenna that no one ever builds, because all the diagrams they see in the book tell them that a dipole has to be horizontally polarized, flat, parallel to the ground, and fed in the center. And that's the traditional way. It doesn't have to be that way. And there's a lot to be said about a pure vertical radiator on HF frequencies. Gives you a much lower angle of radiation, gives you a hell of a lot better performance, and it's just an antenna that no one has used because they don't understand it. And if you, because wire is so cheap, a really smart guy is going to have a vertical dipole.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A really smart guy is going to have a vertical dipole hanging from the tree, another horizontal dipole from the top of the tree, and he's going to flip back and forth between the two, depending on Mother Nature's band conditions of the ionosphere today. And each one is going to have its advantages at certain periods of time. So, go ahead and do it. Any gauge wire you want, Don. N2, LDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, very good. I'm sorry, I probably keyed too fast. I should have waited to see if anyone else wanted to get in there. But yes, very good. Thank you for the answer. I did want to throw one thing out. Maybe after the net or something, I might be listening. I did register at the Echo link, and I had a little bit of difficulty with my computer. It actually works really well with my telephone, my iPhone, but the computer doesn't seem to have audio, and I checked the firewall and stuff. So maybe afterwards I'll wait around and see if anyone has any suggestions for me. Back to you in the net. This is N2LVY.
N2LDY, K2RIW. You're in luck, Don. You're the last guy who signed in. We've handled everybody that signed in early. You've got a computer expert on frequency right now, Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar. And I think he's probably done quite a bit of work with Echolink. So if you pose your question by telling him what computer, how does it act, what did you not like, and I think there's about a 90% chance Bernie's going to tell you what to do next. So go ahead and pose your problem right now, Don. N2, Lima, Delta, Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, like I said, I just got my thing back from them, you know, saying, okay, I'm good to go, and I went to try it. I logged into, Zephyr Hill's repeater, and they saw me in there. They said, oh, go ahead, Don, and I tried to talk, and nothing. There was, like, no, you know, they didn't hear me. So I said, oh, something's wrong. So I checked the Norton and clicked on to say, always allow, you know, Echolink to do whatever it's got to do. And I checked the microphone to make sure, you know, it was, you know, working. And I have nice output in the microphone. I can see it there. I even went as far as going into, like, Audigy, and I recorded myself and double-checked it that way. So now the microphone is working, and I know that I told the firewall to let it, you know, access that, but it still doesn't seem to have, you can't hear any audio.
K2 Yankee Oscar, if you're there, Bernie, what do you believe is the next thing that Don should do? Hope Bernie is there. Go ahead, Bernie.
Yep, Bernie is here.
Go right ahead, Bernie. We're waiting for... I hope you heard what Don said, and maybe you can make the next suggestion for him getting over this hurdle on Echolink. You got it, Bernie. Wonder if Bernie had a sudden battery failure or something like that. We heard you start talking, Bernie, and all of a sudden you stopped very abruptly.
WBG Zeta X Mobile was a possible solution for him.
YO's back.
Okay, Zeta X recognized and YO. Go ahead, Bernie. Oh, hope nothing bad happened.
Negative, just burned through a battery. When we get to the end of this conversation, if the other gentleman can get a pen and some paper, I'll give him my cell phone number, and he can call me right now, and we'll get it straightened out in a couple minutes. K2YO.
Hey, Tom, that's a good offer. If you're willing to give him your phone number, Bernie will call you immediately. Go right ahead, Don.
No, I'll make it even easier. I'll give him my number.
Go for it.
You know what? You guys got to give me like 2 minutes to actually get in front of my computer and a pen and a pad in my hand, and I'll write it down.
Okay, Bernie's going to give me the phone number right now. I'm going to write it down and then repeat it to you, Don. Fire away, Bernie.
516-816-5678. Sequential numbers on the last four. Repeat again at area code 516. exchange 816, line number 5678.
And that's the exact number you've got listed in the Limark roster. Since you live in Garden City, and since the Cradle of Aviation Museum is in Garden City, I'm curious, how close is that to your QTH, Bernie? Go ahead.
If we use Garden City as the scope of my entire world, it's long ways away. I couldn't get further away from it. I live on the other side of town from it. This is embarrassing, but I went to night school at Nassau Community College for, about 3 years to get my 2 years done. I never went to that museum. I keep promising myself one day I'm going to get over there.
Yeah, I've been there twice, and from my point of view, it's worth it. It's quite good. You'll enjoy it. And there's a big celebration going to be held there tomorrow night that I know about, so that's why I was asking that question. Mr. ZDX, from what you heard on what Don was saying, maybe you want to say some words right now. It's your choice. Mr. ZDX, KQRIW.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized the ZDX first.
This is WB2ZX. I was just going to say to try the EchoLink test server where you can check your audio that way without, you know, trying to go to the repeater and seeing if it's working. This way you can make any audio adjustments on the server. That's all I have to say. K2RIW, WB2ZX, Mobile.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. Glenn, go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I know you always make reference to Brown and Woodward, and it just, I think, finally clicked on me today who the Brown is in the Brown and Woodward. There's a very famous quarter-wave antenna engineer from back in the 30s. I guess the publication that I have from Brown on quarter-wave antennas goes back to, I think, 1935. And I just realized that it was George H. Brown that... was part of who made the Brown and Woodward curves, or at least part of that effort. I was wondering if you'd realize that as well. KC2 QIQ.
No, I hadn't. However, I worked with a Mr. Woodward who did an awful lot of work on propagation studies. And I'm beginning to wonder if that was the same Woodward. Sound like these two guys did some real good work. And I'd like to know whether or not they were located at a prestigious place like Bell Laboratories or something like that, or RCA Laboratories in those days, when they actually did this work on the so-called Brown Woodward, used very large diameter conductors for the resonators, for the elements of an antenna. By way of the Brown Woodward curves, I can choose ahead of time what diameter conductor, what length, in order to get whatever impedance of a dipole-like structure or a monopole-like structure. So all reasonable diameters and lengths are on those curves. So when it comes to impedance matching an antenna that you're building, and you want to know what impedance you're going to see, it's awful nice to know ahead of time with 95% accuracy exactly what you're going to see. You don't have to wait and make the measurement and tune and tweak and do all that kind of jazz. Let me drop. So Glenn, do you happen to know what firm... Mr. Brown worked for at the time that he did his real good work?
Yeah, I sure do, Dick. It was General Electric in Camden, New Jersey. And what's interesting there, again, is that they also did quite a bit of, Brown did a lot of work with RCA also initial on some of the initial broadcast antennas. So I'd imagine that Woodward, I'm just looking him up, and I believe their point of contact was... a mixture between Princeton University and General Electric. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Hi, Mike Yankee with the diameter question.
Mike Yankee, we're going to be getting back to you in a second, sir. Let me, where did I have you written down here? Okay, that's Ray. When it comes to the right size for the ground plane for broadcast antennas, I know there's a lot of data that was measured, I guess, in the late 30s, early 40s on that subject. Was Brown one of the guys that was doing all that work, to your knowledge, Glenn?
Well, I actually own his publication. It was given to me in the 70s. And, he was the man. The publication of this book goes back to 35, and the title of it is Broadcast Quarter Wave Antennas. And it has a whole slew of the curves, very, very similar, not exactly the same as the Brown and Woodward curves that were published later, I think, around the time of World War II.
Yeah, they probably did the work for the defensive effort of World War II, but it got published, to my knowledge, a little bit after World War II. Okay, Ray, what would you like to know about diameters of antennas? KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
And 12, Lua. Hey, Dick, and thank you for the answer to the BFO previous and all other answers. I just want to make sure I'm safe because I think we discussed this subject once before, and I went out and ran all the way around the house with 30-gauge wire for 80 meters. So I just want to know if that's safe at 100 watts because you said it would burn up or something at 5.
What I'm saying is that if the wire was dissipating 5 watts, if it had a loss of 5 watts, that might be a threshold where you start getting some grief of the wire. I didn't say it will take 5 watts. Will it take 100 watts? I think the answers are very, very likely yes. And even if you run into a problem where you want to use 30-gauge wire because you want to make it invisible and you don't want to use 26-gauge wire, the highest current is going to be in the center of the dipole. So even if you did burn it up with 30-gauge wire because you want to run 750 watts, let's say, I'm just making a guess, but that might be at the threshold of grief where you do burn up the wire. Since the highest current flows in the center, there's nothing stopping you from using a larger gauge wire in the center where the high current is, and then the rest of the wire out at the tips is the finer stuff, so that you're going to compromise between the visibility and survivability of high power. So if you plotted the current versus length along the wire, there's obviously zero current at the left-hand edge and the right-hand edge, and maximum current in the center, so that plot would look like a Quonset hut, if you know what I mean. A rectified sine wave is what that plot would look like. So, and there's ways of calculating exactly how much current the wire is going to be tolerating, and then by going to the wider tables, you can get a real good guess. Let me drop. At the back of the radio amateur's handbook, they'll tell you how much current each diameter of wire can take. You have to add a little bit of an adjustment to that, though, because of the so-called skin effect. And when you're putting 60-cycle power through a wire out in open air, it can tolerate an awful lot of current. And when you put the 3.5 or 7.0 megacycle energy through it, the total current it can tolerate is going to be a bit less because not all the current flows through the core of the wire, only on the skin effect. But that's maybe a 2-to-1 ratio, if you know what I mean. That's very correctable. Sounds like Don wanted to add something further. N2LDY, K2RAW. Go ahead, Don.
Oh, okay. Actually, I'm in here, and I have the pencil in hand now. I'm at the computer. So that phone number that you were going to give me?
Very fine. Here comes the phone number. Area 516-816-5678. Consecutive numbers. So area 516-876-5678. On the other end of that twisted pair will be Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, and he's fairly sure he can walk you through making that work. Is that a QSL, John? Go ahead.
Dick, I think it was 816, wasn't it?
Yeah, 516-816-5678. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Do you need to fill on that one, Don?
Okay, thank you very much. I have the number, and back to you. I'll be on the phone.
Now, one of the things we discussed last week, remember I told you you don't hear 100% accuracy all the time? I remember talking Wesley into saying that if we had a hollow Earth and a mass in the center of it, that there would be zero gravity. And if we reversed it, if there was a... If the point source of in the center of this hollow Earth was a miniature black hole, that things wouldn't work the same. And I gave that some more thought, and I think I might be wrong. because if what I said last week was accurate, that would say that gravity does not obey the law of reciprocity. And I've never heard anybody say that, so I might have that one wrong. But a more, more interesting subject is that if you start Googling faster-than-light neutrinos, you'll find a zillion articles. And as you start looking at those articles, and you look at the original publication by CERN itself on this subject, you see something very interesting. Let me drop.
Dick, did you want to check with Paul's space report?
Good point, good point. Let's see if Paul is there before we get into this one. WS2N, Paul, what's NASA doing this week? WS2N, if you're there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, here as always. And very good. As far as the space report, just a couple of items, three items I wanted to run through real quick. But one thing is, there's an interesting show on Channel 13, again by NOVA. And it's put on by this Brian Greene, a physicist. And I've seen him before. And he's doing something from one of his books called The Fabric of the Cosmos. Now, part one was on last week on Wednesday. And a 1 hour show. And it's very well done. This guy will take you through, I think next week is all going to be about time. And this one happened to be, what is space? What is space? Everything from, if you were to compress something all the way down to nothing, what would you have to the overall universe, dark energy and all of that. So, he covered all of that last time around. And then it looks like it's going to be a four-part series. It'll be on again this Wednesday. And, of course, you can always pick it up on Channel 21 and many other different ways to do it. Free on demand if you have cable. You can get into Channel 13. They do have the first part on that already, so you can get that free. And you can even make a recording off the free on demand if you have cable vision. Let me drop it. Now, this guy's... Brian Greene, I was wondering what happened to him. He had a very good show a couple of years ago, Elegant Universe. In fact, I think they're going to re-show that again following the show of, next week's show. But, it's good to watch. It'll be all, next week it looks like it'll be about time and all, so we'll see how it goes. I want to bring that up. All science, not only space, but science in general. So, the other thing is Curiosity. I know you're following that launch. The launch date is November 25th. So, the end of this month. It puts Curiosity on Mars in August of 2012, next year, so. We'll be looking forward to that. It'll be launched by an Atlas V rocket. A little different than the previous launch flights. You got Mars Pathfinder and the MER, Mars Exploration Rovers that were launched, Spirit and Opportunity. They all went up by Delta II rockets. And this thing here is big, Atlas V. It's probably got about five times the lift capability. A couple of hundred, almost 200 feet high. It's a big rocket. It's a heavier vehicle. Instead of a golf cart size, it's, the size of a car, maybe a Toyota or something. It's probably five times as heavy as the Spirit and Opportunity. Let me drop a WS2N. We beat that subject to death week after week, but I know we're going to be talking about that a lot more probably at launch time, November 25th, and I'm sure in August 2012. And the other thing that's been in the news, not to get excited about, but the news loves it, is an asteroid about 1,000 feet in diameter coming relatively close to the Earth. And actually within the orbit of the Moon, you know, 250,000 miles out, but, you know, just was inside the orbit of the Moon. It's not going to hit the Moon, not going to hit the Earth, but they're talking about it, and that closest approach is on November 8th. So, thought I'd bring that up. And that's about it for now, Dick. I'd like to see this Atlas V put this thing on, you know, into Mars in August. Atlas V is very successful. It's been launched almost 10 years now with no failures, so I'm not expecting a problem with the launch vehicle. Just the 10 experiment pieces of equipment that are on board Curiosity, I worry about that. Back to you, Dick. WS2S, Space Report, Technet.
Thank you, Paul. Well done. I saw that program two or three times because I liked it so much. That was just a calculator dropping on the floor. The fabric of the cosmic space, you could be talking about the space between the galaxies. You could be talking about the space between the planets of a solar system. You could be talking about the space that exists inside of a molecule. You'd be amazed how much action is taking place in that nothingness that we call space, how much action is really taking place. And that led me into an interesting little experiment that I did a day or so ago. You go to the right website and you ask the question, how big is a molecule? How big is an atom? How big is a proton? How big is an electron? And I found one particular website I can lead you to that's got a very nice diagram. But I tried to relate it to something that you and I can relate to. The biggest thing I know of that we can all easily relate to is a football stadium. And one of the biggest, newest, and best of all football stadiums is the Wembley Stadium in London. The Wembley Stadium, I think, is only a couple of years old. It has a circumference around the stadium, in other words, where the parking lot begins, that is 1 kilometer of circumference. Therefore, it's got a diameter of about 320 meters, about 1,000 feet. So it's 1,000 feet north to south, 1,000 feet east to west, and it's probably got a ceiling that's 500 feet high because I think they can almost close this thing off for the weather. So this is beautiful, great big stadium. And make-believe, let me drop. Make-believe I wanted to make a scale model of something you and I are familiar with, and it wouldn't matter very much if we're making a scale model of a hydrogen atom or an oxygen atom. I'm going to choose an oxygen atom. So if I'm making a scale model of an oxygen atom, and the outer radius of the electrons on that oxygen atom, I'm going to make it fill up the whole stadium. So I'm going to make this oxygen atom, I'm going to blow it up in size so it just barely squeezes into Wembley Stadium in London. Picture that great big oxygen atom, oxygen molecule, I'm going to call it. Let's call it oxygen atom. Now, the outer diameter of those electrons going around it just barely squeezes into Wembley Stadium. Okay, how big is the nucleus? The nucleus, which has got 8 protons and 8 neutrons, 3.2 centimeters in diameter. Dead center in the air, hanging over Wembley Stadium, 250 feet in the air, so to speak, is the nucleus of that oxygen atom. 3.2 centimeters in diameter, 1.25 inches in diameter, is the whole darn nucleus. That consists of 8 protons and 8 neutrons. If you look at one of those protons, how big in diameter is that? 3.2 millimeters. So it's a third of a centimeter is the diameter of one of those protons in the scale model. And those electrons that are zinging around on the outside, how big are those in diameter? Each one of those 8 electrons is 3.2 micrometers. That's around 0.1 thousandth of an inch diameter is the diameter of an electron in the molecule that you and I have blown up a zillion times. We've made it as big as one of the world's largest football stadiums. Everything in between. That's a great big football stadium.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The only real solid object, so to speak, in that huge blow-up of this oxygen atom is that nucleus, which is 3.2 centimeters in diameter. Those 8 protons and 8 neutrons are bunched together as a very hard ball, 1.25 inches in diameter, in a stadium that is almost 1,000 feet in diameter. Everything in between is empty space. That is an ordinary, fairly dense oxygen atom. So when people say that most of space, most of matter is empty space, the example that Brian Greene gave during that program is that if you took the whole darn Empire State Building, Empire State Building is roughly 500 million pounds of concrete, steel, asbestos, plaster, and everything else, wiring. You take the whole darn Empire State Building, 500 million pounds, and if you could squeeze all of the empty space out of it, he showed it as what looks like a grain of wheat in his hand. It would still weigh 500 billion pounds, but if you could squeeze all of the dead space, all of the empty space, in all of the molecules that make up the Empire State Building, it would look like a grain of wheat on your hand, so to speak, weighing 500 million pounds, and all the rest was very careful arrangement of those tiny little particles with all the, you could call it airspace in between, but it's hard vacuum. So when people say most of what we look at is empty, we don't see it that way because we're looking macroscopically, not microscopically. But and if you think that's a very dense portion of this universe, those oxygen molecules or those steel molecules that make up the Empire State Building. Let me drop. You start making a scale model of the solar system, and there is a website where it does that, where they make the sun a reasonable size. Almost all the diagrams you've seen in the book, in order to make the diagram fit on the page, the size of the sun and the size of the planets and the distances between each, you make a reasonable diagram of the sun, and how far is Pluto going to be? It's going to be a mile. A very dense portion of this universe, our solar system. And you start talking about the empty space between solar systems in a galaxy, the empty space between the galaxy. Wow. There's a lot of empty space. And you think nothing is happening in that empty space. You watch that program, an awful lot is happening. So it gives me a different feeling for the state of matter and what's happening, if you know what I mean. Anybody got any questions or comments on what they just heard? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you start looking at the atom, at a specific atom, and you look at the spacing between the electrons, the protons, the neutrons, like you said, and you blow it up to the size of something like a stadium, and the protons, the neutrons, and the nucleus are actually sitting in something about the size of a golf ball in the middle. And what's interesting is, as the atomic count goes up, the basic spacing is almost the same. So what really happens is you're just compacting more electrons within that same stadium and more neutrons and protons inside the nucleus for the same basic spacing. But then that's why when you take something of higher atomic counts, where they get higher and higher, the mass of that item in a smaller object weighs so much more. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Very funny to think about it that way.
Not at all. You listen to any of those lectures by Richard Feynman and some of those other smart guys, and you'll see they had an understanding of this, and it gave them a good mental picture of what's happening at the atomic level, and that allowed them to make predictions as to how their nuclear experiments are going to behave. One of the hard things to accept is that you've got that much empty space in each and every one of those molecules. And in between those molecules, you've got a tremendous amount of space. The air molecules that are in that room with you right now, there's Avogadro's number of them, roughly per cubic foot, 10 to the 23
you put one down with 23 zeros after it, that's how many air molecules there is in that room with you right now, in roughly 1 cubic feet of that air. And inside of every one of those air molecules, we just described an oxygen molecule, 99.99% of it is empty space. And what's in that empty space? The hardest vacuum you've ever thought of. You can never individual oxygen atom, oxygen molecule, O2. In between the oxygen molecules, which are a tenth of a nanometer in diameter, 1 angstrom roughly in diameter, and there's roughly 3 nanometers between them, so there's a 35-to-1 ratio between the spacing between the air molecules and the diameter of the air molecules. Inside of each air molecule is mostly empty space, but each air molecule, if you consider it as sort of a marble, and now how close is the nearest marble away, there's a 35-to-1 ratio of the spacing between them versus their diameters. And what is in between those air molecules? Perfect vacuum. 99.99% of what's in that room with you right now is perfect vacuum. Nothing. Of course it doesn't feel that way. Let me drop. Each square foot of the wall has Avogadro's number of air molecules striking that wall and bouncing off that wall every couple of nanoseconds. There's a zillion of them, all bouncing off the wall. And all of the energy of them bouncing off the wall and imparting a force to the wall, you and I call it air pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch. What does it really consist of? The average air molecule in that room with you is moving 500 meters per second, 1.4 times the speed of sound is their average speed. They're striking the wall, bouncing off the wall, and you and I call that air pressure. But the majority of the room is vacuum. Craziness. Opposite of any reasonable common sense. And this gives you a little bit more feeling for why the bottom of your bicycle pump gets hot when you're operating the bicycle pump, the pump of that tire, your car tire, your bicycle tire. The equation we all have heard in our college chemistry classes or our high school physics class, PV equals NRT, that tells you as you compress the air, it gets hotter. The equation tells you how much. It doesn't tell you why. Air that's hotter is simply air that's moving faster. Air that's hotter has a higher speed of sound because it's the individual air molecules conveying the extra speed forward as a wave. That's what you and I call the leading edge of that sound wave. Let me drop. We think a sound wave is really like water, you know, where you've got high and low points in the water, and in the case of air, you've got high and low air pressure points. Sort of true. What's really happening, the high pressure points and the low pressure points are simply places where the instantaneous temperature is higher, because that's how you make the air molecules move faster. That's how you measure a higher pressure. When you're measuring the air pressure, the 14.7 pounds per square inch, against your body, against the wall, against your pressure gauge, you're really measuring the rate at which those air molecules are moving and bouncing off that wall or that measuring surface, that gauge. How fast are the air molecules bouncing off the edge of the gauge, you could say. That's what you're measuring when you measure air pressure. And so the instantaneous high and low pressure points of a sound wave are instantaneous places in space where the temperature is higher or lower, which means the air molecules in that area are moving faster. An airplane that flies at a high altitude experiences air that has a slower speed of sound. And you think it's because the air is thinner. It's got nothing to do with it, per se. The speed of sound is only a function of the temperature of the air. How fast are the air molecules moving? That's what temperature means. Your thermometer measures how fast the molecules of air are moving. That's what temperature is. Boy, that wasn't made clear in the classes that I went to in high school and college. I wonder if it was even slightly explained that way in your school. You maybe went to a better school, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't think I have much more to add, Dick. I think you said it quite eloquently. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, John recognized, but let me go back to you for a second there, Glenn. In the school that you went to,
and what you and I are just now discussing, did the school give you that mental picture, or was it something you had to develop much later in life? The school I went to gave me a bunch of equations, gave me a bunch of concepts, but I never could put it all together as to that mental picture. My schools, plural, did not give that to me. Did your schools give that to you? Did you get that message? Or did it take you some number of years downrange studying it, so to speak, to really get the message? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I think the message was there, although it's the way that they explained it was a little bit different than the way you did. In other words, in most cases, most of the professors that I had at the time kept, you know, saying about the models of atoms that they're always changing, and that, although the models of the atoms are changing and our view of it are changing all the time, the one things that have been relatively constant all the time are the energy equations. So what they would do generally is they would deal with, you know, mass and then energy, and then we would always work the energy equations. So we would look at, like, electron counts, things of that point, and then determine, you know, for a certain volume of mass between chemistry and in physics, that we would always work with the energy, because regardless of the exact mechanics of the, you know, of each individual atom, you know, another 2 more years would probably be another model of it. So we concentrated a lot more on the energy side of equations, Dick. I think a lot of universities still do till today. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, in that method of teaching, they're giving you the equations that allow you to do the calculations as to what the chemistry is going to do, and those equations tell you how much, but they don't tell you why or how. What's really happening at the molecular or the atomic level? The equations don't tell you that. And therefore, it becomes a memorization of a bunch of symbols on the board that you and I call the equation. But the one thing I know is that until we read the CERN experiment, I thought I knew what the speed of light was. Therefore, I don't have to memorize a bunch of equations. All I know is the speed of light, and I know the frequency I'm worrying about, and therefore I can divide one into the other, and I can figure out how long the antenna is going to be, if it's going to be a half wave or quarter wave, and then I add the velocity factors and shorting factors and whatever. I'm able to derive those things as opposed to big memorization. Maybe John has already solved this problem. KC2WGB, go ahead, John. K2RIW in the tech net.
Back in the old days, at the school, most of that was taught as vibration was the air molecule and the cause of temperature rise and things like that. But the formulas were the same. Not a very good explanation, I agree with you. As far as the atom and the vacuum you're talking about, remember now, recent discoveries that the dark matter occupying a lot of the universe, we might have dark matter inside of the atoms themselves. What do you think about that?
Possible, but when it comes to the way an atom behaves, you heat it up to certain temperatures. In the process of heating it up, you're making it move faster, and in some cases you're exciting it to higher energy states as far as its electrons in their orbits are concerned, certain quantum states. And whether it emits as a black body radiator or as it emits individual chunks of energy, quantum of energy of light, we've measured those molecules quite well in laboratories under various pressure and temperature conditions. So the way a molecule emits, the way an oxygen molecule emits, a hydrogen molecule in free space emits 1420 megacycles energy, emits and absorbs. It's very resonant at 1420 megacycles, a free space hydrogen molecule. Let me drop. So each of the molecules under various conditions close to what we think are going on in free space, we've measured them. And now you go and measure the rate of rotation of a galaxy and the velocity profile. In other words, how fast are the individual stars going around the center of the galaxy? How far are they going around halfway out? How far are they going around at the perimeter? You look at those velocities versus radius, and you end up with a very different curve than what you expect. The Hold-On galaxy should be operating where the center spins very fast and the outer perimeter spins very slow. You see that when you have a low Earth orbit satellite that's got to move at 17,500 miles an hour to be in orbit, a low Earth orbit satellite, like the space shuttle. You take a synchronous orbit satellite, 22,000 miles